Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. When fatigue isn't relieved by rest and recovery of, say, a week or even a month, other considerations may be involved. Pollution, malnutrition, and stress can lead to damage in all our crucial systems, including the endocrine system that conducts adrenal, thyroid, and sex hormones, along with the circulatory system and the detoxification system. This affects our nervous system and can lead to a long-lasting suppression of cellular energy. In other words, a world of hurt. What is the etiology of fatigue, and how is it tied into depression? Once there's damage to these systems, how easy is it to heal? It may surprise you that when humans and animals are at the end of their lives, the right nutrients can sometimes cause a dramatic improvement. So while industrial medicine tries to relieve symptoms, orthomolecular health medicine uncovers and treats the underlying systems that need support to heal, not to just feel better, even with seemingly intransient fatigue and depression. Join me today for a discussion about fatigue and depression with orthomolecular physician Dr. Richard Cunyon. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. A village in Ecuador has caught the attention of scientists interested in increasing how long we live. Some people in the village are immune to cancer and diabetes, two of our society's most significant diseases of aging. Researchers also say that these Ecuadorians have a potential for long life, were it not for their high death rate from alcoholism and accidents. These Ecuadorians have a medical condition referred to as Laronne syndrome. This syndrome is the result of a defect in the cell receptors for growth hormone that limits their height to less than 4 feet. The New York Times article reporting on these people entitled Ecuadorian Villagers May Hold Secret to Longevity, tells us that the gene that causes the growth hormone receptor defect is similar to one researchers have studied in animals such as roundworms. When the roundworm gene is removed, the worms live twice as long as they normally would. This has scientists and drug companies very excited. This view that there are genes for this and all of our other characteristics, genes that cause sickness and health, including genes for our mental and emotional life, is deeply embedded in our culture and media. The metaphor is something like a string of biochemical dominoes with a gene at the beginning and some health outcome at the end. Knock the gene over and click, click, clickety-clack, you live a long time, or you get cancer, or you have a heart attack, or you become a schizophrenic. From what I've been reading lately, this idea of a gene for something or other has been more or less abandoned by scientists working in the field of genetics and genomics. One reason for this abandonment is that work has shifted from studying genes to studying DNA molecules and the part they play in recurring biochemical processes. In other words, DNA is just one of many chemicals involved in the recurring chemistry of life. One of the many discoveries about how DNA works is that many, perhaps even most, stretches of DNA associated with a gene occur in more than one place on the genome. This makes functional sense, since demand for the protein that a stretch of DNA participates in creating can increase beyond the capacity of a single DNA span to accommodate. So copies exist to help. Each copy is likely to differ from the others. So it now becomes difficult to say exactly where the gene is located. Instead of a line of dominoes with the gene as the ultimate cause, one scientist has suggested the metaphor of life as music, with DNA molecules as one of the instruments in the orchestra. In this metaphor, the music that is life is created by the coordinated effort of all the players and their instruments. And don't forget the venue. Music is profoundly affected by the environment in which it's played, for its acoustics, for its inspiration of the instrument players, for its inspiration of those experiencing the music. The idea that genes work like the first domino is very attractive. It seems simple and direct. People like simple and direct solutions to problems. It gives us some comfort that the people in Ecuador who have Laronne syndrome have a simple explanation for their condition that could enable them to live long lives if they only stopped drinking and stopped acting carelessly. The idea is that in these people's genes, there is a way to extend their lives, and maybe even a way to prevent cancer and diabetes, all by striking the right domino. The music metaphor seems much messier. If the music isn't right, it might be an instrument that's not in tune, or an instrument that's missing, or too many instruments of one kind, or a combination of instruments that isn't right for the piece of music being played, or too much from one section of the orchestra, or maybe even something that's wrong with the venue. A few weeks ago, the Journal of Internal Medicine carried an article with the title Factors Associated with Reaching 90 Years of Age. The research had many flaws, but what it concluded was that among a group of men born in 1913, how long a man's father lived had nothing, statistically speaking, to do with how long the man born in 1913 lived. How long his mother lived had a little bit to do with how long he lived. On the other hand, what had the most significant effect, hands down, was whether the man smoked. There's no doubt that DNA is involved in the biochemistry that shortens a smoker's life. But do we really need to know what stretch of DNA is at work to know that we should toss smoking and other toxins out of the concert hall? A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, fatigue and depression, and our guest, Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, M.D., formulator of all of the Olaloa products, is a nutrition-oriented physician and orthomolecular specialist with over, I'd say now we're up to 40 years of experience in the nutrition medicine field. He pioneered the use of vitamins and minerals in today's medical practice and was co-founder of the Orthomolecular Medical Society with Dr. Linus Pauling in 1976. He's written several books, among including Mega Nutrition and Mega Nutrition for Women, and many published articles in the Townsend Letter, San Francisco Medicine, and other scientific journals and publications. In 1994, he founded the Society for Orthomolecular Health Medicine, which is the OHM, and it is at OHMSociety.com in San Francisco, a large and well-respected professional organization whose mission is to put nutrition first in the practice of medicine. Through this organization, Dr. Cunyon brings together medical doctors and other health practitioners to discuss current nutritional approaches to treating disease states. In Dr. Cunyon's own medical clinic, he practices a strategy of nutrition, detoxification, and adaptive support that integrates all aspects of modern preventative health care. And we're always so happy to have you on the show. Welcome to you, Dr. Cunyon.
Well, thank you, my dear Lena. In fact, that was such a succinct intro that we could almost skip the talk.
Yeah, we just, that's it.
Defined health medicine,
yeah,
which is really one of the major points that we're going to be talking about today, that the idea of supporting your health and healing mechanisms is an essential aspect of healing from fatigue and from the underlying causative factors that we're going to be discussing here.
So do you want to talk about the differences between fatigue and depression and how they sort of dovetail into each other?
Well, that says it right there. They do dovetail into each other, because if you're suffering from a particularly a habitual or chronic state of fatigue that is ongoing, there is a loss of function, a loss of quality of life, a loss of so many of the little things in everyday life that are part of one's expectations, that the psychological impact is significantly depressing. There is a psychological component just to being in the, what Humphrey Osmond, one of the great philosophers in medicine and in orthomolecular medicine with Abe Hoffer, he wrote about this as an essential thing, the idea that there was an expectational set and that medicine had to address that expectational set as a part of whatever other treatment, whether it was nutritional-based or whether it was pharmaceutical-based. I'm talking a long sentence here, and I almost got lost myself in the middle of it. But the point is that the health medicine acknowledges the psychological aspect of illness. Mm-hmm. It's so obvious that, however, being myself a what I call a recovered psychiatrist, I'm no longer looking for psychological factors to be the whole picture.
Right.
As I once did, I actually went into medicine hoping to find a powerful psychological intervention through whether it would be psychoanalysis or Pavlovian conditioning or behavior therapy or hypnosis or even what I came to term operational therapy, where I taught people literally to get in touch with their positive feelings and mental images to accompany them. That was way back in the 1960s. That I expected that to be curative. And so it was a major change to get off into health medicine, ultimately via what we call orthomolecular medicine, which was marking Linus Pauling and Abraham Hoffer, and became saddled with the concept of megavitamins way back in the 1960s. We're far beyond that. Your description was succinct and much, actually more to the point than mine. But I'm kind of weaving a little history in here along with where we're going, which is simply that the biology, you are all us. The biology is an important and treatable factor in every psychological illness, such as depression, because, well, it's an oxymoron the way I stated it, because it's not just, every depression has a biological component. If for nothing else, for example, in depression we find typically a persistence of activation of the pituitary and the adrenal, so-called pituitary-adrenal axis, which takes the pituitary gland hormone, ACTH, and turns on the adrenal hormones, adrenaline and cortisone. And this goes on all the time. That is, on a chemical level, a definition of stress. Unrelenting stress mm-hmm. that leads to exhaustion, insomnia, depletion, and physical manifestations that are become a vicious circle with the what may have been the initial psychological stress or shock.
So what I'm hearing is that there's a kind of wheel that starts spinning really fast, and one thing affects the other and revs it up, and it keeps spinning. And that what sometimes needs to happen, because all of what you just described, when something damages the system and it starts revving like this and producing all these other byproducts like cortisone and cortisol, and then people can't sleep, for God's sakes. I mean, they really can't sleep is one of the things they say. Something has to put a stick in the wheel to stop the wheel. And more often than not, in order to sort of deal with damage in the system, you're looking at damage caused by environmental pollutions and endocrine disruptors and all these other stressors. But nutrient deficiencies are usually, you know, nutrient interventions are usually the stick that stops the wheel.
Right. And in fact, you just described verbally what we all recognize as yin and yang, the little wheel with the mind and body, so to speak, the psyche and the soma interacting in a way that reaches the infinity at both the microcosm, the small end of it, meaning the cells and the molecules of the body, and the macrocosm as we touch into the universe itself to its extreme.
Yeah. Well, let's get into some nitty-gritty stuff. We've got all these factors that cause damage to the system. It's not something that people haven't heard me talk about. You know, the nutrient deficiencies, endocrine disruptive chemicals, pollution, stressors, all causes inflammation. Then you've got free radical production. Then people's aging accelerates, and you see diabetes and homocysteine gets high and kidneys fail, and all this stuff is happening. So you've got someone aging very fast. And the good news is that from your vast experience, when you introduce very targeted nutrition, you can actually correct some of these things, but you have to use fairly high doses sometimes.
Well, that's true. In fact, I've had two calls to my on my voicemail in the last week. One was just this morning of a fellow who was fatigued because he was wrestling with a pancreatic cancer. And the preparation for surgery had been omitted by his conventional institutional care, and we found here that we had a significant read on his nutrient needs and did some of it by intravenous immediate administration. Intravenous is quite safe because if you are using larger doses and the reaction is not good, you simply turn off, you might turn off
you
the
stop it.
IV and you have it under control. In this case, we got an excited phone call that the staff at the hospital where the tumor turned out to be a relatively early tumor that was removable. But in addition to that, the recovery from the surgery was so profoundly mm-hmm. rapid and dramatic that the staff couldn't believe their eyes. I got the excited phone call from the family of this particular person. It's a great way to start the day with that kind of a fan mail approach. But a week earlier, I had a very interesting case that bears witness to what we're talking about here. Here is a guy who came from a well-known, internationally known cancer clinic, treated there for liver cancer that followed upon 30 years of viral hepatitis, both B and C, both of which could cause liver cancer. And he had the misfortune that it converted into cancer, and the cancer had become so widespread that his entire liver, all lobes, were infiltrated, and his portal vein had thrombosed, so he was literally a kind of a worst-case situation. And he was sent to me to actually administer chemotherapy. But I took a look at the case and realized nobody had taken care of his nutrition-first needs. So I managed to get the testing that identified significantly what was required. I won't go into the details here, but the point is just it's simple enough. It's what he needed. And we did that plus some additional antioxidant. Some people find it controversial, but in this case, the glutathione acted as a quick sort of a put-out-the-fire kind of antioxidant. And with one intravenous treatment, when he came back for a second treatment about a week later, he was actually able, whereas first time he was almost carried into the office, the second time he took the bus 30 miles from an outlying suburb to get here and feeling and looking like literally a new man. It was just absolutely amazing.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone today with Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N. We're talking about fatigue and depression. So, Richard, if you would, can you give
literally, us... Literally, that's an example of medically induced fatigue. I'm giving it as an example.
Yeah, well, no. Medical... that people forget when they're fatigued to look at whether or not they have recently had a medical procedure or they're on medications. So medications, pharmaceuticals, and procedures of various sorts, including even various forms of radiation and stuff, are going to cause enormous amounts of fatigue. What else are triggers for fatigue? I mean, we talked about central nervous system overstimulation causing exhaustion and getting people caught in a high cortisol, which I pointed out is also an artifact of exposure to wireless. It cranks up the sympathetic nervous system. And,
right, so an unfriendly environment, whether it's energy or whether it's persistent cloudy weather up in Seattle or whether it's persistent freezing cold weather here with the, off the ocean in San Francisco, there's a, you know, the Golden Gate Bridge beckons to some people whose systems cannot adapt to that kind of stress.
Right, and then there's endocrine disruptive chemicals and pollution, and you have a list of them, and the first on your list is fluoride, which is in most municipal drinking water system. So fluoride is particularly...
That's right. Most of America is moderately to significantly poisoned by this enzyme poison, fluoride, which, by the way, is well known to block a... if those in the audience who like specifics, among other enzymes, one of the enzymes it blocks is enolase, which is right on the energy pathway for the utilization of carbohydrates.
Wow.
And in fact, there are those who contend that this fluoride factor is a piece of the action for the epidemic of obesity. It's
and
not
diabetes
by itself, but at least it's one more kind of straw on the adapted requirements for the organism. And of course, we were talking yesterday, and your first thought on fatigue was thyroid.
Well, I usually think of thyroid in the adrenals, and you were talking about thyroid in the liver,
yeah,
which
but
is really
thyroid by itself. Sure, the liver has to convert the thyroid hormone, the so-called thyroxin, or T4, into the triiodothyronine, or Cytomel, which is
T3.
Mm-hmm. And that reaction goes on in the liver, and the liver evidently has the proper molecular intelligence to make the right decision as to whether or not you're up to the challenge of ramping up your thermostat. That sounds good.
Oh, that's an important point, is that the body has is trying to protect you from overstimulation, so it starts suppressing certain things, like it turns things down.
Sure, at the cellular level, the thyroxine, or especially the cytomel, is like the whip that beats the tired horse.
Mm-hmm.
If you're too tired, that can make it worse. Just like if we get into the so-called chronic fatigue, with people whose fatigue is unrelenting, not for days or weeks, but maybe months and years on end, and there the thyroxine is inclined to be adverse if it's an overdose, and exercise, which is therapeutic for ordinary depression, for people who still have adaptability. For those who have the chronic fatigue and the serious fatigue syndrome, exercise beyond the point of stimulation and into the point of depletion or exhaustion, exercise makes it worse. Not because we're talking and saying so, but because we're describing what patients tell us.
Right. Well, and in fact, chronic fatigue was first seen, as I mentioned to you, in peak performance athletes. So people who were, you know, exercise to the right amount of exercise, the amount that you can recover well from, increases all kinds of parameters in your body and makes you healthier, but it turns all of those things backwards and starts to attack them if you over-exercise, and that's individual, of course. The other thing is that when you start having the liver and the thyroid and the adrenals not functioning well because of some of these injuries from the environment and maybe even viral, you know, sort of chronic viral things, the sex hormone balance doesn't function. You can't, the whole endocrine system has a handshake, so nothing works if something is out of whack. And then you've got a person who isn't functional on an energy and the brain, the cognitive function is gone. All of this starts to go.
You know, in real life medical practice, we are not seeing a lot of adrenal shutdown, the so-called Addison's disease.
Right, not shutdown.
Well, actually, it is kind of a shutdown where the adrenal is so underperforming.
No, Addison's is. I'm saying that what we're seeing.
We're seeing the early stages where people, if we test them through the saliva or the urine, particularly the saliva is convenient for this, you'll find the early morning cortisol output is high, and then it drops in many cases by midday, not to recover until they have a night's rest, which restores some degree of competence in the production of these hormones by the adrenal gland. And you can only surmise from this that the gland is either exhausted or damaged.
Okay, well, let's stop for a moment because I want to make sure that we get some indication in here of what can be done about this before we run out of some time. One of the things that's important to look at in this situation is the health of the gut and nutrient deficiencies, the specific megavitamin things that you play. But there's also food sensitivities and gut inflammation so that they're not absorbing. And then there's issues with circulation, which we can get into more. But just let's go back to some of the underlying causes, and let's now maybe address some of the things that can be done for the things we've already mentioned. So you've got...
Why not take the two most common first, which you probably have on the tip of your tongue already, which is simply wheat and milk.
Right, so you get rid of the food sensitivity, so at least you have a person beginning to digest food, which helps with the malabsorption and the nutrients, but...
What's really important there is that to maybe not always discussed properly, is that the effects of wheat and milk are... They're related, and they have sometimes similar ultimate effect, but they're different in this sense. Wheat induces an inflammatory reaction in the upper GI tract where folic acid is digested and absorbed.
So all of the important vitamins for energy, the B vitamins, specifically the B vitamins that work to increase methylation, which helps with your detox pathways in your liver, all of those are knocked out by this type of gut inflammation. And I might mention
folic acid knocks out the part of the so-called the relay, where you're relaying a carbon atom from folic acid over to B12. But folic acid absorbs upstream and just after the stomach in the duodenum and jejunum, whereas B12 has to go all the way from the food where it's digested by stomach acids, and if they're not there, that hurts. And then also there's a protein in the stomach that acts like a protective coat that carries the B12 all the way to the appendix area of the gut, to 20 feet downstream. And there is where the milk kicks in. And the milk kicks in because the milk sugar, lactose, very often silently fails to digest. And so what happens is that the intestinal yeasts and some of the bacteria then have a free ride. They get a free meal. They can eat the milk sugar that your body couldn't break down and absorb upstream. And what happens then is that milk sugar is turned through the chemistry of these organisms into an acid product that causes constipation, for one thing.
Oh, my.
And in other cases, sort of a low-level chronic diarrhea with unformed stools, and you just kind of, you know, you don't like to look down there and see what you're putting out. But in addition to that, the acidity factor lowers the pH, or in other words, increases the acidity of the stool at the critical area in the terminal area of that small bowel as it plugs into the cecum, the big furnace part of the large gut where the appendix is. And by golly, if you there's a critical level of pH between 5 and 7 or 6 and 7 where if you don't have the right pH, the B12 does not absorb. So the folic acid is blocked by wheat intolerance, and the B12 is blocked from absorbing into the system and is wasted, therefore. Even if you take it as a pill, it may be wasted.
Right.
If you're chronic bowel dysbiosis, inflammation,
right,
low pH in the terminal ileum. This was the real eye-opener for me. When I learned this, I said, holy moly, this means you can have milk intolerance and say, well, I just got a little gas down there. You know, it's not nothing. But if you're depending on your gut to absorb the B12, not likely to happen very efficiently.
Richard,
that's the point.
Richard, I have a question. My experience, first of all, I just want to make a statement that in my practice, I see it as not just wheat. I see it as all the grains, with the exception of maybe those that are not really grains, like quinoa. But I see it in all the grains that
Correct.
There's some. Okay.
Well, they all contain gluten.
Even if they don't have gluten, some of them are just the types of proteins and the fact that the grains were kind of poisonous till they were hybridized. But so clearly going on, as I always talk about, the pre-agricultural diet where you're eating, you're avoiding the grains and you're having, and corn as well, and you're having these other foods. The other thing that happens is that we have a diagnosis that I remember from back in the 80s that's back, and there's terrible misunderstanding about it. Everybody is getting diagnosed with candida. And I've talked about this myself, but I'd like you to go after that, because there's a lot of misunderstanding about what candida is and whether or not it should be, whether or not it's a core issue in terms of this inflammatory pattern, and I think
sure.
It's not.
Well, candida is a saprophytic yeast. It's one that is in the human body at all times. But it turns out that yeasts all are antibiotics. And most any yeast is able to kill all other yeasts.
So if it's an antibiotic, why is it often associated with overuse of antibiotics as a cause for it to grow?
Well, because it's a tough son of a gun. Everybody else dies and candida lives. Not only that, when candida gets the upper hand because the other bugs are being killed off by the antibiotic, but the candida may survive that. And then we have to take a look at chronicity. Why then doesn't it go away? Why doesn't our body send out the troops to eat it up and get rid of it and poop it out, stuff like that, which are our natural defenses? After all, the body is a detoxification machine. Why doesn't it work better? And the answer is at least, I'll give you two of them. You could probably do dozens, but let's take the top two in my book. Number one is that we have weakened people. People that I'm seeing come to me because they don't come for entertainment. They come because they're not feeling well, and they want someone to help them get their health back. And so when you take a good look at it, you find out many of the people have never taken seriously the wheat and milk thing and never gone long enough on a elimination program to see the results. It takes at least 2 to 3 weeks of careful behavior to find out whether that is a big factor in your health. But if you are not absorbing your foods well, what would the reason be? And one of the major reasons is that upstream, the pancreatic gland, it does more than just deal with blood sugar through production of insulin. It also has to put out enzymes that digest proteins and fats in particular. And if your proteins and fats don't digest, and then if the terminal stages of carbohydrate or sugar digestion are incomplete, there is all that undigested food going through your gut downstream where the yeasts have easy pickings.
Yeah, I've got to take a musical break.
Okay.
Can you make a note to yourself so you can go
well,
right
I'll
back to that?
I'll take a break there because methylation is the key.
That's
to
the key.
The pancreas.
So we'll go back to that in a moment. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Alsett, and I'm on the phone with Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N-M-D, and we are doing a show about fatigue and depression. Richard is an orthomolecular physician. We're going to take just a brief break. Please stay with us. We've got a lot more to talk about. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, and I'm on the phone today with orthomolecular health medicine physician Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, and we are talking about fatigue and depression. I just want to remind you that Richard's website for the Orthomolecular Health Medicine Society is ohmsociety.com, and they have a meeting every year, so you can go there and find information about this year's meeting. A reminder that there's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, all kinds of links about our guest, our practice, free stream, an hour-long stream of this week's show, our archives, our CDs, our book, all of it. It's at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out. And you can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. So, Richard, we were about to get into this idea that lack of absorption because of gut inflammation, since the body's not digesting the food properly, that one of the problems here is corrected if you can correct methylation. But methylation is a concept that people's brains kind of explode around. So can you explain it? A little?
Well, we've already begun because we covered the fact that with food intolerances, the most common and well appreciated being wheat and milk, the milk sugar and the wheat protein. The wheat protein is called gluten. The milk sugar is called lactose. That these, literally these food chemicals are not agreeable to all of us. In fact, there's a significant almost a majority, it's a significant minority of the population that really gets sick and don't know it. That's why it's worth talking about, because once you can look for it and figure it out, you can live your life healthier and better. Now, as I said, folic acid will be blocked by malabsorption in the case of wheat intolerance, and B12 is blocked and malabsorbed in case of lactose intolerance. And other, by the way, there are disaccharides, double sugars, in many fruits. So a lot of folks can't handle fruit juices and don't know it. Even orange juice or pineapple juice, loaded with orange juice in particular, with sucrose. I think pineapple also is a sucrose.
Yeah, that's
a sugar. It has to be broken down, and so some folks don't, because they don't eat it as a regular, don't recognize that it has an adverse effect. But in any case, what I'm getting at is with the loss of absorption of folic acid and B12, there's a breakdown of that biochemical pathway, that essential chemistry of the body that repairs our carbon atoms, that passes a fresh carbon from food into about 400 different enzyme systems in the body that produce almost everything we know about feeling good and having a lot of energy in life. For example, there's an amino acid called methionine, and the methionine is one of the 10 essential amino acids. Well, this essential amino acid is so hard to get out of food that Mother Nature has invented a way to pass a carbon atom directly from certain foods, for example, beef borscht, directly to the to restore the methionine.
Yeah, you said beet, just in case people heard beef. It's beet, yeah, B-E-E-T, because that's where you get
right,
the
betaine. So the product is called betaine.
Right.
And as you know, we put that in as the featured item in our vitamin line of the Ololoa. But
yep.
Because it's not easy to get in a regular way, and for people who are already unhealthy or malabsorbing, this is the easiest and cheapest and most reliable way to bypass the problem.
Now,
what happens then is that the products that are produced, the first organ that is restored is the pancreas. In other words, the pancreatic function, within an hour of blocking the methylation process, if you block the passage of this simple little carbon atom from the vitamin source, folic acid and B12, and to its enzymes that produce these 400 major products, roughly 400, if you block that, within an hour, your pancreatic gland, the digestive portion, turns off. And that is big news, and that leads, if it's habitual or common, or if you have the misfortune to have the bad bugs crawling up the inside of your gut and making it up to the pancreatic and liver ducts, you end up with a pancreatitis. But in addition, whether or not that is a featured aspect that apparently is related to pancreatic cancer also. So this is a major understanding that it isn't the yeast that's causing the problem, but it's the pancreatic sensitivity that turns off digestion as one of Mother Nature's probably adaptive tricks that needs to be attended to in every case. Even if you do want to treat the yeast, you also have to treat the pancreas. That's the point.
You know, one of the things that's very interesting, because we've been talking about malabsorption and food sensitivities and gut inflammation and how that has to be corrected and how that dovetails into methylation and blocks methylation. This also has a profound effect on circulation, which is a primary cause for sleep apnea. I don't think people understand that sleep apnea is a symptom of a problem in the circulatory system with the blood.
Well, that's right. And I didn't, you know, I was trying to make it a little easy for the audience to not have to hear too many new words, but the word that goes with that is the word homocysteine.
Which
is increased with sleep apnea. And homocysteine is, actually, we just mentioned methionine. Methionine becomes homocysteine simply by doing its job. When methionine passes on the carbon atom, it loses the carbon, and that changes methionine into homocysteine, and then homocysteine is stripped. It's running to get another carbon atom from wherever it can. And if it can't find it coming from folic acid and B12, or if it can't find it coming from betaine, it's going to try to take it right out of the wall of the blood vessel. When it does that, it attacks the proteins in the blood vessel and the lipids, particularly the LDL, and so it becomes a major factor in causing arteriosclerosis and, before that, causing episodes of spasm, inflammation, and clotting, especially in the wear and tear areas of the vascular tree. Could be anywhere.
Talk about fatigue.
And especially one of the wear and tear areas is in the neck. It's always moving. You get in the car, you get hit from behind, a whiplash, boom. Mm-hmm. It doesn't just give you a whipping of the head. It causes clotting inside the vertebral arteries, which are inside the bone of the neck. And then they come together inside the skull and form a single artery called the basilar artery, which controls sleep. It's as simple as that.
So Richard, we're saying that that accidents and injuries are also a primary cause for insomnia.
Absolutely, and sometimes they're not bad enough to attract attention. You didn't get knocked out. You didn't get killed. You just got thrown around a little bit, or maybe even you might have even been dancing, or having physical activity that was, or playing golf badly or something, where you do it to yourself. Or even a chiropractic treatment has been known to cause a stroke, in case you didn't know.
Oh, that's not a good thing to say.
Well, it's a fact that rough or incorrectly applied manipulation of the neck. One guy, self-applied chiropractic after he took a fall on a ski slope and managed to stroke himself on the spot, doing it wrong.
Well, I think it indicates...
But the point is, certain people also are genetically designed or already inflamed in their vascular tree, and they clot easy.
Right.
And that's the point. So it turns out that mega vitamins like vitamin C, vitamin E, niacin, B6, that these are all anticoagulants. No wonder they have cut the heart attack. You know, Paulin came along and had people taking vitamin C in large doses back in 1970, and that coincided with the major drop in the age of getting your first heart attack.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm doing a show today with Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, M-D, called Fatigue and Depression. Again, if you want to get a hold of Richard, you can go to his website to see information about the meetings every year, which are open to the public, ohmsociety.com. And we'll go back to our interview.
To stay on the subject of fatigue, I think we ought to discuss, as long as we have just mentioned methylation and all these fancy words like homocysteine and methionine, that when they lead to the 400 products, the number 1, 2, 3, and 4 products all have to do with energy. For example, the methylation of a product that makes membrane fats, otherwise known as lecithins or phospholipids, that enzyme passes a methyl group to methylate a simple little alcohol molecule that becomes choline. And then the choline becomes acetylcholine, which is the turn-on for the entire nervous system. Acetylcholine is the wake-up chemical for the brain. But then beyond that, the same interactive chemistry leads to the production also of adrenaline, not only in the brain, but in the adrenal gland. Well, who's going to have energy without your adrenaline? Who's going to have motivation without that, not only in the adrenal gland, but in your brain? So the methylation factors, folic acid, B12, B6, and betaine, those big four, are really the gateway to a self-care approach to being high energy and healthy and a lot happier, because once you find out you can do things, you've got control of your life in a way that money can't buy by itself. But beyond that, beyond acetylcholine then, as a neurotransmitter, you've also got coenzyme Q, which is part of the passage of the electronic forces in every cell in your body. Therefore, it is the life, it's the gateway to the life force. It requires these carbon atoms in constant supply. Carnitine, which transports energy into your cells, without which there's no fuel for the cells to eat at that microscopic level, the little invisible world inside our own bodies. That carnitine requires 3 methyl groups. So, wow, there's another inside the cell. There's a little calcium carrier called calmodulin. That requires a methyl group from the same mechanisms. It's utterly amazing. A dopamine itself has a receptor called D4 that uses homocysteine to methionine as a switch to turn it on and off according to the need for producing the phospholipids. The mechanisms I'm giving it to you kind of in random order, but you get the idea. There's a lot of action here that most of us doctors were never taught about.
Well, what's clear from what you're saying is that, I mean, one of the things I was trying to interject is that I always worry about people hearing something alarming, like how easy it is to hurt your neck, and then boom, you've got, you know, you have a stroke or something, or you.
No,
it's okay. Let me just.
Happen.
Of course, all kinds of things can happen to people,
right.
But the point is that what you then said is that if you have proper nutrient balance and if you're taking the right nutrients, that's not going to happen. So one of the things that's interesting about homocysteine is that it's formed by sulfur-containing amino acids, which are absolutely essential for the methylation process and also for the liver to detoxify, because it's on the way to making glutathione. That's how you make glutathione. So all I was going to say is that I think there's some reason for people to exercise, because along with taking the right nutrients, if your body is mobile and strong, and that's all of your body, including doing some sit-ups where your neck gets a little, you know, that you have much more stability then also.
Exactly. There's another side of this that you probably know very well, which is that exercise, among its other virtues, after all, that's what we're designed to do. We're animal. We're designed to move. And moving in a way that stimulates our biochemistry induces every cell in our body to increase the chemical process of making energy. In fact, when you put cells under the microscope and take a good look, you find out that exercise can increase the energy packets, the containers that contain the chemicals, by about 500%.
Right. That's recent research.
Athletes,
wonderful.
They have a 5-fold advantage. That's why they don't get tired. Listen, I knew one of my guys was able to literally run 3 days or 2 days straight. He could run 200 miles without stopping. He peed on the road, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Day and night running. Well, he was a marathoner, but an ultra-marathoner. These people are a true prodigy when it comes to manufacture of energy in the cells, but they define the enormous capacity for adaptation and for energy production and energy tolerance that we mere mortals that we have. We're the closest thing that we know to gods. And I have to tell you, when we use ourselves properly, take care of ourselves wisely, and live our lives constructively and creatively.
Well, you know, that brings up an interesting question, which is that it's clear that not everybody's mitochondria will do that, even with training. Because, I mean, I trained in my young years, you know, starting in my 30s. Well, it actually started in my 20s, but in my 30s, I really ratcheted it up and this and that. And I discovered that there was a limit to how far I could go. And I also see people in my practice who are reaching for peak performance and their bodies aren't supporting it. They're not letting them go. So what is the difference between someone who has the capacity to train to that level and people who reach a certain point where they can train and get better, but they've reached a kind of limit to how far they can go and be able to recover properly, which is how you avoid getting sick?
Sure. Well, we're back to our formula that we used at the beginning of our introduction, which simply is a systematic survey of the possible factors to the best of our professional ability.
Yeah, that certain damn things.
Nutrition, pollution, and stress as the major treatable factors. This is early medicine. If you take care of nutrition before you get damaged, if you take care
That's
of
right.
detoxification before you're in a death door, if you support the adaptive part of your body with the right kind of even hormonal support,
yeah, for sure,
you'll find that you can head off the premature aging that and damage that afflicts many otherwise very disciplined and competent athletes who don't know any better, and they burn out, literally burn out, because either their pituitary gland is suffering from excessive stress, or it's otherwise possible that they have some susceptibility in the mitochondria themselves. We know that ischemia, for example, low blood flow, can cause extra mutations, for example, in the heart muscle, that after the heart attack, it ain't the same heart, that there are more mutations. And so it is possible for the DNA in particular of these energy packets, which are high energy, therefore they get hot, they burn out. Or it may be up in the pituitary gland or some other regulatory system that we don't yet understand entirely that controls regeneration and stem cells that lead to the recovery and the healing of tissues.
Well,
that's a huge question that is only partly understood at this point.
Yeah, that's something I want to stop you at, because that's very interesting, because it's we were talking about both of us have observed that, as I mentioned at the start of the show, that both animals and humans can be very close to death and suddenly have a remarkable recovery if you introduce the right nutrients at the right dose, if you suddenly give them a strong dose of something they really need.
Sure. Well, that was the patient I told about who had the liver cancer. It was really not just fatigued. He was actually waiting
dying.
To die.
Yes.
And one treatment turned it around, so he literally has gone from death's door to a very positive, almost normal appearance, other than his swollen liver and whatnot, which was not stopping him. He's got hope. He's got energy. He's got a sense that he can maybe at least, if not beat this thing, have a certain indefinite, I don't know well enough to know how far it will go, but certainly a new lease on life. And it's wonderful to know that we're that close, that we can do that, not with some newfangled latest patent medicine, but we can do it with established physiological, biochemical factors that we call nutrition.
Well, some of these cocktails that you have to produce for somebody, I mean, we had somebody come to us who was disappearing out of my mind. His kidneys were tanking. I mean, he was, you know, he's losing kidney function, kidney failure. And there's a cocktail that you had recommended to me for a cat. and of course it works on humans too, but these are rather large doses of these substances, which is the trimethylglycine, which is your betaine, and then the alpha-lipoic acid and the carnitine. And then, of course, we added CoQ10 and a few other things. But giving a person or an animal a very, very strong dose of these things, in other words, this idea that people have that you can overdose on vitamins is unfortunate, because in the case of someone who has really become damaged and is really impaired, you give them a very, very powerful dose of the stuff, and they'll recover, and it's remarkable.
And what also makes it the more remarkable is that a sick animal, including a sick human being, very often isn't eating as much, so they're in a semi-fasting state, not to mention that the body metabolism is feeding on itself.
You can see it's catabolizing.
And
yeah.
In that state, the enzyme that uses betaine is turned on threefold to fivefold. It's a huge ramping up of that enzyme called BHMT, so that feeding betaine under those conditions has an almost miraculous effect. If you just are starving and you don't have the betaine, you're ready to die. But if you get the betaine with it, you're ready to heal. It's an amazing transformation that goes with it, and it makes perfectly good sense once you know your science and your chemistry.
So that brings me to another issue, which is, what happens, so betaine, again, for people, it comes from beet, so it's called betaine, but there's also a type of betaine that is a substitute for hydrochloric acid. So they're both made from beets. But this is trimethylglycine, or TMG, trimethylglycine with a G, and is the issue of people fasting and also people on vegan diets. What happens to their methylation and detoxification under those conditions?
Well, that's a complicated question that we're not going to have enough time to finish, I don't think. But I will say that the vegan diet, one of its advantages is that vegetables are rather high in the betaine. On the other hand, animal products such as eggs and meat, and especially liver, contain not only the whole panoply of the required vitamins, but also the high amount of choline.
Well,
choline is
sulfur.
C-H-O-L-I-N-E. Yeah. And choline is part of every cell membrane in your body. If your body wants to capture choline and convert it to betaine, it can do it, but at the cost of cannibalizing itself. Whereas by eating these foods, you can also, in an animal diet, be assured that you're going to have a source of betaine, so long as you can oxidize the choline into betaine and then use it as your source of methyl atoms that make everything work better.
Okay, so let me just ask you something, because I remember you saying that the problem that happens with vegetarian and vegan diets sometimes is if they are not including sulfur-containing amino acids, which come from animal protein, so the sulfur-containing aminos are the methionine and cysteine that are in there, that there's a problem, that it interferes with detoxification and methylation. But now what you're saying, which is really interesting and really important for people to hear, is that if they include beets, for instance, in their diet, that they will get the betaine and they will be able to do this even without the sulfur-containing aminos?
Well, the purpose of betaine was to restore methionine, so your body can make do on less. That's the point.
Yeah, but you have to have some.
But you still have to have some.
Some.
And granted, I'm not a major fan of the vegan diet, but I'm not a major fan of a carnivorous diet either. I kind of like a mixed balance, but people have to find their own balance. That's
certainly
the secret of a happy, healthy life, is finding what kind of balance. In fact, I created the Balance Point Diet as one part of my work with people to do that very thing. And the vegan diet has its problems for some people. I mean, supposing you're vegan and you don't digest beans and grains very
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
You have a chronic malabsorption, as we described earlier. I mean, I've seen vegans who became a typical vitamin B12 deficiency syndrome with paranoia and dementia.
I need to, we're getting very close to the end, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you to say a word on behalf of antioxidants. We've only got a couple of minutes, but antioxidants are terribly important with this whole picture of fatigue.
Well, there's no question that the reactive oxygen. That one of the major toxins in the body is fragments of oxygen that we call free radicals. That when the body doesn't burn the oxygen and restore it back to its gas state, and which can be transported by blood and is safe to deal with, instead the oxygen in its little particles, those particles are reactive and they'll react just like homocysteine does, a homocysteine free radical, with the lining of the blood vessels, and so they are clearly implicated as a cause of damage to blood cells and to the lining of the blood vessels, and this provokes clotting, and it'll show up especially, by the way, in the lungs, where you'd think the lungs could handle all kinds of oxygen because that's what they're breathing in every day. But when the oxygen is also the form of a free radical in the blood going through the lungs, it seems to cause lung diseases, especially in some people who lack certain antioxidant backup systems, like one's called A1AC. Big name, but worth knowing about for maybe 5 to 10% of the people out in the audience, because it's a genetic factor. In any case, the free radicals from oxygen are detoxed by antioxidants in your body. These oxidants detoxify with superoxide dismutase and with glutathione in particular, and those are the two major ones. And the backup for these endogenous or manufactured in your body antioxidants, SOD and glutathione, the backup is vitamin C and lipoic acid. And it goes on from there. Vitamin E for absolute sure, and all the lipid.
Vitamin A.
And
yeah.
Then in the low oxygen areas, carotenes, all those carotenoids are there to safely suck up the free radicals and protect the tissues from being damaged. So we could help it with the supplements of these things and these antioxidants, and that's probably how these antioxidants are anticoagulant. They prevent the oxidative fragments from stimulating the conversion of fibrinogen into fibrin, which is to say the substances circulating in your blood at all times, fibrinogen, are chemically altered by these free radicals, and they convert into threads, sticky threads, that ultimately stick together and become clots. And even a partial clot is dangerous. You don't have to clot all the way and get 100% blocked. Even a partial increase in viscosity is known to knock out function. In fact, that's how homocysteine does it. Your homocysteine goes up after a meal, and in cases where it gets out of control, you may end up with severe fatigue, brain fag, as the blood vessels are A, in spasm, and B, reduced in flow, and C, the blood is thickened up, and the oxygen doesn't get through. In fact, a layer of this fibrin, one micron, a millionth thick, slows down the transfer of oxygen across the vessels.
Yes, and I might mention, we're completely out of time, but I might mention that this is not cholesterol. This is inflammation.
That's right, inflammation and fibrin.
And oxidative stress. Dr. Richard Cunyon, K-U-N-I-N, at OHMSociety.com. You can go there to find out when this year's meeting is. It's open to the public. I urge people to enjoy that again. If you want to reach Richard directly, it's 415-346-2500. And I want to thank you for your work and spending this time with us. I think we've gone a long way to explaining fatigue and depression today.
Well, thank you so much, Lena. You're always great to talk to. You make me feel like I know what I'm talking about.
Oh, and you do. Thanks
thank
again.
You,
okay. Bye-bye. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream, a full hour stream of this week's show, our archive CD copies. Everything is there at yourownhealthandfitness.org. You can email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Remember, Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Jeff Fawcett and Lena Berman. And being informed, it not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.